Today we're beginning here on the top of Mem Chedimon Aleph by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Mishalo Bichra Ishto, an individual whose wife has yet to give birth, Ve'elda Shnei Zicharim, and then she has twin boys. Natein Heislaim the Kohen, the father pays the Pidyon HaBen, because Mimonavshach, one of the two children was a Bechor, because his wife had yet to give birth, and so he for sure is Chayav here in Pidyon HaBen. Meit Echad Mehem B'toch Shloshim Yom, one of the children passes away within the first 30 days, Av Patur. Then the father is no longer obligated in paying the Pidyon HaBen, because then we don't know whether the Bechor was the one that passed away, or it was the non-Bechor that passed away, and then you have a din of Amotzi Mechaveiro Alav Araya, and since nobody can bring evidence to the fact that the one that is alive is the Bechor, then he's not obligated to pay over here, and Hu Adin Nami LaBen, as Rashi says, this is true not only of the father, it's also true of the son himself. He will not have to pay for the Pidyon HaBen, because the same safek that exists for the father exists for the son. Now, even though technically Pidyon HaBen is a mitzvah, nevertheless, the mitzvah involves a monetary obligation or is connected to a monetary obligation. And therefore, if you don't have a monetary obligation because Motzi Mechavero Alav Araya, then the same thing applies in terms of the doing of the mitzvah, that we don't do the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen when there is no monetary obligation involved. Meita Av, if the father passes away, Vabanim Kayamim, and the children are alive. Rabbi Meir Omer, Im Natanu Ad Shelo Chalku, if they gave the Pidyon HaBen before they divided up the estate, Natno, then they gave it. Vim Lav, if they didn't give it, then Turim, then they are Patur. So Rabbi Meir conditions this on the state of the estate, which is that if the estate is still an aggregated estate, then they have to pay for it, even though the Mishnah says it in the language of if they paid for it. Nevertheless, it's not just if they paid for it, it means that they will pay for it if the estate is still aggregated. Once they divided up the estate, then for Rabbi Meir, you create a certain safek, which then you're unable to overcome, because then each of the children is independent, and the Kohen doesn't know which of the two children is Chayav, neither do the children themselves know which one is Chayav. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Nitchaybu Nechasim, the possessions of the father are already obligated to pay for this, implying that it's irrespective of whether the estate is still aggregated or has been divided up, the lien that the Kohen has on the property pre-existed the splitting of the estate, and therefore the Kohen can collect from the estate. Zachar Unikeva, if this individual whose wife has yet to give birth, for the first time now gives birth to twins, a male and a female, ain't on the Kohen quote. Then the Kohen has no claim whatsoever, because there's a possibility that the female was the first of the two, and therefore we don't even know if there's a Bechor here. It's a Safek Bechor. When it comes to a Safek Bechor, there's no obligation to pay the Pidyon HaBen because of Motzi Mechaveiro Alav Araya. You can't prove that the male is a Kohen. Now, how these situations happen or how they come about, Rashi later on will say, B'machbeh, that they were doing it in secret. They were hiding out from the enemy. And they were giving birth in situations where it wasn't obvious what was going on. There wasn't good lighting. Situations in which the conditions were compromised, and therefore they don't know which of the two was born first, which of the babies is the Bechor. You could see it happening even extat. It could happen. It used to be that before the hospitals marked babies that they used to get mixed up. Now they do extra precautions where they make sure that the baby has the same bracelet as the mother, and they check it 3 or 4 times because there were real issues of getting babies getting mixed up. So even in normal situations, it can happen. But Rashi says that the conditions were extreme, and that's why it happened here. Demita av emat. When did the father pass away in this situation? Ilema demita achar yom yom. If it's a case where he passed away after the 30 days have elapsed, Bahama Rabbi Meir, on this Rabbi Meir says, ki chalku p'turim, that if they divide up the estate of patur, v'ha ishtabin nuhu l'nechzai. Aren't the possessions of the father already encumbered or have a lien on them for the payment of the Pidyon HaBen? Everybody agrees, once you hit the 30-day point, the father is obligated to pay the Pidyon HaBen. That obligation then puts a lien on his possessions or on his property. Given that, then what does it matter whether you keep the possessions together, have an aggregated estate or a divided estate? The possessions are already obligated. So then why does Rabbi Meir say that if you divide up the possessions, you don't have to pay? Ella demit betoch lamed yom. It's rather that he died within the first 30 days. Maishna ki chalku. Then why does it matter when they divide it up? Da'azel degabi hai umidachile. Da'azel degabi hai umidachile. Once you divide up the possessions, you go to one son, and he says, I'm not the Bechor, go to the other one. Go to the other one, he says, I'm not the Bechor, go to my brother, and therefore the Kohen can't collect. Kilo chalku, even if they don't divide the estate out, nami liza legabi hai, v'lidche, he'll go to one of the two brothers, and he'll say, please pay for the pidyon of Ben, and he'll say, it's not me, it's my brother. Liza legabi hai, v'lidche. And he'll go to the other brother, and he'll also say the same thing, it wasn't me. If that's the case, how can it be that when it's prior to the 30-day point, that Rabbi Meir says that if they didn't divide up the estate, that you have a right to collect? Once again, each person or party that he goes to is going to say to him, I'm not the obligated party, and he's going to send him to the other party. There's no single party to go to. Even though the estate is an aggregated estate, there's still two owners of the estate, and each owner is going to tell him, I'm not the obligated party, he's not going to be able to collect. The truth is that if it's before the 30-day point, even Rabbi Yehuda's shita is a little bit problematic. The Gemara only asks about Rabbi Meir's shita, but then how is Rabbi Yehuda's shita going to fit if it's prior to 30 days? Because Rabbi Yehuda says that the nechasim are mishubadim, that the possessions are already encumbered, or there's a lien on the possessions. How is there a lien on the possessions if it's before 30 days? There's no obligation on the father at all yet. So that might relate to a machloket we're going to see in tomorrow's daf between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot as to why the chiyuv of pidyon ben only takes place after 30 days. We'll actually see it in one of the mishnayot today, and then we'll speak about it more tomorrow. Rashi says the reason is in order to ensure that the baby is a viable entity and it's not a nafel. So we wait the 30 days. But according to Rashi, the obligation exists from the moment the baby's born. It's just in suspension or it's in abeyance until we hit the 30-day point. Once we hit the 30-day point and we know that it really is a viable entity, it's not an nafel, then really retroactively the chiyuv started from the time that the baby was born. The Balei HaTosafot, on the other hand, say that it's a gzeira takatuv, meaning that you have to wait 30 days irrespective of the status of the baby. Even if the baby was kalulo chadashah, even if the baby made it to full term, and therefore we have no questions that it's a nafel, you still have to wait the 30 days. So you see from that it has nothing to do with the nafel, it has to do with the fact that it's a gzera takatu. You don't pay pidyon ben until 30 days. So if Rabbi Yehuda holds like Rashi over here, then maybe you could overcome the problem. According to Rabbi Yehuda, there might be a nitchaibu nechasim even prior to the 30-day point, meaning that the obligation already exists at that point, and if it wouldn't be a question on Rabbi Yehuda, it would only be a question on Rabbi Meir. So that might be a way to get around the problem, or it could be that Rabbi Yehuda believes that there is a shibud nechasim that exists before the 30-day point, just the obligation to pay only enters after the 30-day point. If that's also the way that you formulate Rabbi Yehuda's position, and that's why the Gemara only asks on Rabbi Meir's Shita. The truth is that the Gemara might just be using Rabbi Meir's Shita as a way to indicate that neither of these work, and we have to come up with another solution. It might be true of Rabbi Yehuda as well, that it doesn't work for Rabbi Yehuda either. The Gemara just picked Rabbi Meir because he has two options, and they want to show that both options don't work, depending on how we set it up. So now we're in a bind as to what is the situation or scenario in which Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir argue in our Mishnah. So Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, Zot Omeret. From here you can conclude that Shnei Yosef and Shimon, Shayu B'Yir Achat, they're two individuals with the same name in a city. V'lachu Sadeh B'Shutafut. And they purchased a property as partners. Now they're partners in a property. They have Yosef ben Shimon A, and Yosef ben Shimon B are the first and the second. They now both jointly own this property. Balchov, there is a creditor that has an outstanding loan with a Yosef ben Shimon. Now, Gove Ota Mehem. He can go and collect from them. Damalei, because he can say, Ibi didach masikna, manta didach kashokilna. Says, if you are my debtor, I'm taking your piece. Vi bechabrach masikna, and it's your buddy over there that I have the outstanding loan against, manta dechabrei kashokilna, I'm taking his half of the property. So here you have a problem that a creditor is in a bind, which is he lent money to a Yosef ben Shimon, and he can't collect on the money because he goes to one of them and the individual says, I'm not the one. It was the other guy who borrowed from you. Goes to the other one. He says, I'm not the one who borrowed from you. It was the other guy. He can't prove which Yosef and Shimon. The creditor can't collect because he can't prove which of the two debtors owe him the money. But now we have a way to go after them because you are in a joint possession. They own something together. And if you go after that property, Mimon of Shoch, has the debtor involved with it. So if he goes in there, he can take up to 50% of that property and say, you guys figure it out. I know that 50% of this property is definitely encumbered to me because of the loan that I made, and therefore I can collect 50% of this property. You guys can work out which one of you is the 50%. Even though, interestingly enough, he's hurting even the party who did not borrow money from him, because in the end, who knows what's going to happen with the residual property? They're going to split it 50-50. We don't know what's going to happen. He might hurt the other party, but nevertheless, he's empowered over here to go in and collect his 50%. So now, that's similar to our case over here. You have two brothers, one of which is chayav to the Kohen, Pidyon HaBen. Now, according to Rabbi Meir, when this estate is aggregated, basically that's the equivalent of them being partners in a single entity. And therefore, the Kohen can go after that property because he's going to say, Mimon of Shach, one of you guys owes me the money. I'm taking it from your joint ownership over here. And then you guys can work out which of you is chayav in this money and you figure it out between you. But for as far as I'm concerned, I'm coming after the right debtor over here because you guys jointly own the estate. Once they divide the estate up, you can't do that anymore because they don't have any joint property in which you can go after those monies. So that's Rabbi Yirmiyah's view. And Rabbi Yirmiyah says that our Mishnah is supportive of what I'm saying over here, because our Mishnah is basically saying that according to Rabbi Meir, when there's an obligation on a joint property, then the creditor can go after that joint property. And it's exactly what's happening over here, according to Rabbi Meir. So Amar Rava, Rava says, Michte, Nichse de Barnish inun Areven Bey. The possessions of an individual are his guarantor. Mi ika mide de lide lo matzi tavale. Is there such a situation in which you can't go after the primary debtor, ula arev matzi tavale, and then you can go after the arev, the guarantor? Rava now introduces a question on Rabbi Yirmiyah's assumption. And it's not clear here whether Rava disagrees fundamentally with Rabbi Yirmiyah and thinks that Rabbi Yirmiyah's assumption is incorrect, or does he disagree with Rabbi Yirmiyah's connecting his din to our Mishnah? So Rava could be arguing that our Mishnah is different than the din of the debtors and creditors, or he could be arguing that fundamentally your whole understanding of the ability of the creditor to go after the debtors in this case is incorrect. That's not, because we have a Mishnah. Someone who lends money to a party, a debtor, with a guarantor. Lo ipara min arev. You can't go after the guarantor. What does it mean you can't go after the guarantor? That's the whole point of having a guarantor, is that you can go after him in case the loved doesn't pay. But kaimalon lo yitva min arev tchila. You can't go after the guarantor first. You have to go after the debtor first. You first have to exhaust your ability to go after the loved. If the loved defaults and doesn't pay, then you can go after the arev. That's the whole point of the arev. And that's what Rava says here too. The property is an arev. The property is a guarantor to your ability to repay this loan. And therefore, you have to go after the primary individual. The primary individuals are the debtors over here, the brothers. They're the primary individuals. Once you've exhausted your ability to go after them, then you can go after the arev. Over here, since you can't get the debtors to pay, you can't go after the arev, because the debtors don't have to pay because of their claim. Then you can't go after the guarantor and say you pay if the debtors themselves don't have to pay. So that's Rava's statement here, rejecting Rabbi Yirmiyah. So now, again, I mentioned before, this could be either fundamental, or this could be something where he's trying to detach it from our Mishnah. It could be fundamental, which is, how do you view land vis-a-vis a debt that is outstanding? Yes, the Gemara says in other places that the properties of an individual are arevim, are the guarantors for that individual. How literally do we take that? So Rabbi Yirmiyah is taking it not so literally, whereas Rava is taking it very literally. Rava says that property is a secondary means of collection, not a primary means of collection. The primary means of collection is the personal obligation of the individual. The person who committed to repay that money, he's the one who's obligated to repay that money, and he's the primary debtor and obligated party. The property is a backup for that. So if that primary obligation or the chiyuv agavra fails, then you go after the property. That's how Rava looks at it. And given that, we know the rules are, if you can't get it from the loveh, then you get it from the arev. So here, if you can't get it from the loveh because you don't have a claim that allows you to get it, then that same claim should fail with regards to the arev. Rabbi Yirmiyah might argue on that and say, that's true by a regular guarantor. That's not true by property. When the bank lends you money for your house as a mortgage, they're not lending you based on your personal guarantee. They're lending you because they have an underlying asset that guarantees your ability to pay. Over here, it's very different. The land itself is part of your personal guarantee to repay the loan. It's not like you can separate it away from your personal obligation versus the property. The bank only lends because of the property and because of its rights or lien on the property. That's why they have a mortgage. They have a lien on your property. So you can't sell it. You can't do anything with it until you've repaid that mortgage. That's the exact reason why they lent the money. It wasn't because, yes, in every case, the arev is a guarantor. But that's only a guarantor. It's a backup. Over here, land is the primary reason why they're lending, not a backup reason. So that could be a fundamental machloka between them as to how to view the nature of property in the guaranteeing of a loan. Rava sees it as a guarantor, not as the primary part of the obligation. Rabbi Yirmiyah sees it as a part of the primary obligation. Land is the reason that he lent it to you. You don't look at it as an arev. It may be arevim, but arevim in the sense that that's part of the package that allows you to lend money to this individual. So that could be a machloket between them, a fundamental machloket. The other possibility over here is that Rabbi is saying that there's a difference between the case that you brought and the case of our Mishnah. It might be true that in the case that you brought, you can go after the two parties, because over there you have a creditor-debtor relationship. And that creditor-debtor relationship made it that you now have a lien on that property. And that lien on that property you can now exercise because of the fact that you're taking the 50% that belongs to you. That may not be true in our Mishnah. Our Mishnah may be a different situation because over there, there was never a party that was absolutely obligated or entered into a transaction with this individual. The Torah says that they're chayav. We don't know which one of them is chayav. So no one individual entered himself into a situation where he obligated himself. By the debts, one of the two parties entered himself into such a relationship and created such an obligation. Because here, clearly one of the parties is lying. And in that case, we do trigger the necessity for the arev to stand in. Because that's exactly when the arev committed himself to pay, is when the loveh is not willing to pay, even if he's lying not to pay. And that's why you can go after the joint possession over here. On the other hand, in our case, neither party is lying. They don't know about the obligation from the outset. And therefore, why should their properties be obligated in a case where they themselves are not obligated? So over there, maybe you can say that the creditor can go after the joint property, even though it hurts another party because he has a right to collect. By the case of the Pidyon HaBen, it's never clear that any of the parties was obligated, or none of them obligated themselves in paying this. In that case, maybe you don't have a right to go and collect from the joint property and hurt another party just because of the fact that the Torah says that there's not an obligation here. So maybe that's a less fundamental way to understand why Rava rejects Rabbi Yirmiyah, not because Rabbi Yirmiyah is wrong, but because Rabbi Yirmiyah vis-a-vis our Mishnah is wrong. It's a different case than the case of Shutvin. Now the Gemara says, Ella, Amar Rava. So now Rava has to offer a different explanation for our Mishnah. Lo'olam shemeit lachar lamed yom. Case here is clearly where the father died after 30 days, where the obligation already exists. If there was plenty of money in the estate, everybody would agree, Rabbi Yehuda, that you go after the estate and you get the money. The estate was encumbered to the Kohen or to the Pidyon HaBen because the obligation devolved upon the father when we hit the 30th day. Given that, there's nothing to discuss. The Kohen can get his money no matter what because from the Nechasim of the estate. And here we have an unusual case. You go in the Lekka, the Chamesh Salah Islaim. There's only five Selah left in the estate. The Tosafot already mentioned this at the beginning of the Gemara, that the Gemara already makes an assumption that the property is encumbered to this Pidyon HaBen, and doesn't say anything about that, or doesn't question that at all. Tosafot says, in that statement of the Gemara, is embedded a number of Machlokot Amoraim, and the Gemara is taking a position in them in order to get to that conclusion. It says it as if it's a given, but it's only really a given once you go through all these Machlokot Amoraim, and here are these Machlokot Amoraim, which the Gemara took a position with regards to, and Rava is also now saying that this Mishnah is premised on a number of positions that are subject to Machloket, and we're taking a stand with regards to those Machlokot. The first of which is Ravasi's position. Dam Ravasi, Achim Shechalku, brothers that divide up estate, Mechsa Yorshim, Umechsa Lekuchot. Half of them are Yorshim, half of it is Lekuchot. This is based on a Machloket Amoraim between Rav and Shmuel. Rabbi Yochanan is also involved with it, as to whether when individuals inherit their father, do we say that the inheritance results in a division of the estate to the point where each party is receiving what they belong to them, or in essence, Breira, and therefore whatever you got is your Yerusha, and your sole Yerusha, or do we say that the Yerusha has to get divided up, there's some sort of division of the property that we don't know about, and since there's no Breira, they're basically bartering between them their different positions, which is that each one of us owns whatever percentage of the estate, and that percentage in every single item, but we have to come up with a means of dividing up the estate. And we're never going to get it so that everybody gets exactly what they're supposed to get based on the division of the estate. So we give is each party gets a piece, and they sell or they trade that to give the other piece to the other party, or basically you become purchasers. You are basically bartering the different parts of the estate so that each person gets their piece of the pie, but even though it may not be their piece and was someone else's piece, but you traded that for another piece of yours that you gave to someone else. And therefore, you're considered to be buyers. So Rav says, they're Yorshim. Shmuel says they're the Kuchot. It has ramifications when a Baal Chov, when a creditor comes and collects from one of the brothers. He comes and collects from one of the brothers. Does that brother have recourse against the other brothers in the estate? That will depend on whether you consider them to be Yorshim or you consider them to be Likuchot. So according to Rav, who says they are Yorshim, you have to redivide the estate up because it shows that he didn't get his proper allocation because the Baal Chov came and took that piece from him. But according to Shmuel, who classifies them as Likuchot, then the person that purchased that Sadeh has no repercussions or recourse against the other brothers, because the sale was done shlo b'achrayut, without recourse. So the division of the property is the kuchot that are ena b'achrayut. Rabbi Asi actually takes a middle position and says, I don't know. I don't know whether they are kiyoshim or whether they are ke the kuchot. So there's a fake whether there is breira. It's a fake if there is no breira. And therefore, we then come to the conclusion that half of it, 50% of the estate, will be viewed like a Yerusha, and 50% of the estate will be viewed like Lekuchot, as if they were purchasers from each other. And Tosfot actually discusses over here that maybe the suffix of Ravasi is whether they are Lekuchot, not Yorshim at all, but whether they're Lekuchot with Achrayut, Lekuchot with recourse, or Lekuchot without Achrayut. And in that case, they would always be deemed Lekuchot, so it's the question if they have recourse against the other parties or don't have recourse against the other parties. For that reason, Tosfot favors a particular girsa and explanation of the Gemara in Bava Kamma that makes it obvious that Ravasi is focused on it being split between Yerusha and the Kuchot Shelo B'Achrayut. So then, you have now an estate, it's a five Selah estate. The brothers are each getting 2.5 Selah from the estate. Of that 2.5 Selah, 1.25 of it is considered to be their real Yerusha, and 1.25 of it is considered to be the Kuchot, as if they purchased it from each other, or a transaction that took place between them that allowed them to each take that 1.25. So I have two pieces of the estate by each brother, one piece which is Yerusha, one piece which is considered as if it was Lukucha, as if it was purchased. Now even though, as the Baal Tosafot point out, there are Rishonim that believe that we do Paschim like Sumchus in other places in the Gemara, who says that Mamona Mutav is Safek, and you have money that's in a Safek, Chokim, you split it up. So that would be the same thing over here. It's mamona mutav is a fake. We don't know if it's lekuchot. We don't know if it's yerusha. So we split it. We make it half yerusha, half lekuchot. So there are rishonim that believe that this is evidence of the fact that we pass them like sumchus, and that there are a number of other gemaras that seem to indicate such. Tosavot is against that view, and he says we pass them like the rabbonon, which is a motzi mechavero alav haraya. The reason that in this case and many other cases we split it when it's a safek is not because we pass them like sumchus, rather that's a takanat chachamim, that in certain instances they made it like a vadai 50-50 split. It's not because we have a safek, therefore we're splitting it 50-50. Rather, we have a safek. The Chachamim then instituted it that it becomes now, instead of being a safek anymore, comes 50% vada Yerusha, 50% vada Lekuchot, and that's their solution to the problem. Nothing to do with Sumchos, it's the institution Midrabanan. And that's what's happening here as well. So according to the Baal Tosafot, this view of Ravasi is a compromised position. But it's a compromised position that, yes, derived from a safek, but it's not because of the safek. It's not because there's a safek chokim, but rather because of the safek, the chamim came up with this solution to deal with the problem, and this is that they'd say, anytime now that you get a rusha, 50% of it will be viewed as a rusha, 50% of it will be viewed like a purchase transaction. That's number one. Udukuliyama, the second assumption we make over here is, milve hakatuv b'torah. If you have a debt that is written in the Torah, lav kiketuva b'shtar damya, that's not like a documented loan. That's not like a loan that is inside of a shtar. This is a machloket that's found in the Gemara in Kiddushin. It happens to be that Rabbi Yehuda will say, is of the opinion that milva aktuva b'Torah is kiketuva b'shtar damya. An obligation that's written in the Torah is as if it is written on a shtar, and therefore you have the right to collect as if you have a shtar as a creditor, versus a case where you view it as a milva alpeh, which is an oral loan. The difference between them is whether you can go after encumbered property. When you have a milva ktuva b'shtar, that's as if the lien on the property has been registered with the title office, and then anybody who lends money after that basically knows that there's a lien outstanding, and they're lending with that risk in mind, that the lien preceded them, and someone else can come after this property before they get repaid. Since that's information that they know, we say that the party, the creditor, can go after purchasers of the property or even lenders who were later lenders than him. He can go after any of their collections because of the fact that he has a first lien here, and it's a publicly known piece of information because it was done by shtar. And a shtar has a kol to it. In their day, because they deemed sign on it, it made a ruckus about it, everybody knew about it. But, so therefore, if we assume that you have that information, it's the equivalent of registering it in the title office. On the other hand, when it comes to a milva peh, how is anybody going to know when somebody lent money in an oral loan, whereby they never documented the loan, how is a buyer after that point in time, or a creditor after that point in time, have any idea that there was a loan outstanding beforehand? Therefore, over here, you have no ability to go after encumbered property, because there's no way that the people who came after you would have any idea that this credit was outstanding. There's no registration of it. So now, that makes a huge difference as to whether it's a milve b'shtar or a milve alpeh. There is a machloket with regards to this issue of whether milve ktuva b'Torah is considered to be a shtar or it's considered to be a milve alpeh. The difference will be whether you can go after encumbered property. So the Gemara is saying we're taking a position here that milve ktuva b'Torah is lav kiktuva b'shtar damya. It's not as if it's written in a shtar, and therefore, because the kohen has a right to the pidyon aben over here, doesn't give him a right like he's holding a shtar. Gives him a right as if it was an oral loan. Rashi says that when a milva ktuva b'Torah is a situation in which zakeh le'rachmana l'kohen, that the Torah gave you such a right to collect it, that's what makes it that you have a milva ktuva b'Torah. And that's what they argue about, whether that's considered like a milva ktuva b'shtar or milva alpeh. Tosafot doesn't love that explanation because the Torah also says that you have to repay loans that you took out. If that's the case, then why isn't that also a milva ktuva b'Torah? Rashi in other places differentiates between whether you're the generator of the obligation or the obligation is generated by the Torah. By case of a loan, you generated the obligation, therefore it's not considered to be as a milva ktuva b'Torah, even though the Torah says you have to repay it. Whereas over here, by Pidyon HaBen, that's something that you didn't obligate yourself in. That's something the Torah obligated you in, and therefore, that's considered to be a milvah ktuvah b'Torah. Though the problem with that explanation is arachin, which we'll get to in the next mesechta, whereby that's also classified as a milvah ktuvah b'Torah, and there you are the generator of the obligation, because you need to take a neder arachin in order for your suv to be chayav. And yet there it's still considered to be a milvah ktuvah b'Torah. Therefore, Tosfot over here says that the difference is, Hainu dafka kagon pidyon ben arachin min zakin kiyotzvem, shlo nitchaybu m'lo shuchaybo haTorah. You would not be chayav unless the Torah obligated you over here. Aval milva peh, even though it read in the Torah that you have to pay it back, came in the law of Hachib Shito Utsyeshal the Shalem, Mashilvo. Even without the Torah, you would have to pay that money back. It's not something that the Torah created, but not only that, it's not something where the Torah gave the amount. So there's two factors here that make it a milva ktuvah b'Torah. It's something that is not an obligation that you would have assumed had it not been for the Torah. And number two is the Torah sets the conditions or the amount that is to be paid. By the case of a milveh, you would have had to repay it irrespective of the Torah, because that's the whole point of borrowing money. And number two is that the amount is not set by the Torah. You set the amount that you borrow, so there's no limit or set amount that is structured by the Torah, and therefore it's not considered to be a milveh ktuvah b'Torah. The third assumption over here, Odekuli Alma Yidlu de Rav Papa. Everybody holds a Rav Papa. This is a third position here, and a big assumption as well. Rav Papa is also a compromised position. Damar Rav Papa, milveh alpeh goveh min hayorshim, veino goveh min halukuchot. When you have an oral loan, you're allowed to go after the inheritors of the property. You're not allowed to go after the lekuchot. You're not allowed to go after the buyers of the property. So Rav Papa, again, is a compromised position. There's a view that a milveh alpeh can't go after anything at all. There's a view that a milveh alpeh can go after both the kuchot and yorshim. Rav Papa is the middle position, which is you can go after the yorshim, you can't go after the kuchot. The Gemara in two different places, the Gemara in Kiddushin and the Gemara in Baba Batra, discuss the position of Rav Papa. In one place, they say the reason that Rav Papa's position is correct is shalotin ol delet bifnei lavin, so that people will not stop lending. If you don't allow people to collect, they're not going to lend money. So in order not to shut down liquidity in the market, they made it sure that you can collect from the Yershim, even though you can't collect from the Kuchot if you lend on an oral basis. That's the reason given in one place. In the other place, the reason given is Shibuda Midoraito. That Mina Torah, a lien exists. When a loan is extended, there's a lien that's created Mina Torah. That lien that's created Mina Torah then allows you to go after the Yershim afterwards when you have a Milva Peh. The Chamim suspended your right to do that when it was the Kuchot because they wanted to keep liquidity in the market. If we allowed you to go after the Kuchot, which you have a right to do, nobody would lend money anymore because they're always afraid that there's a Milva Peh, which they don't know about, that could supersede their rights here, either in buying the property or in lending money to you. So for that reason, you go after the Yershim, you can't go after the Kuchot. So now, you have three assumptions over here. The first assumption is Ravasi, which is when you have an estate that's divided, 50% Yerusha, 50% Lekuchot. Second assumption is that a milveh ktuvah b'Torah is not like a milveh b'shtar, so you're dealing with a milveh alpeh. The third assumption is Rav Papa. Now that we're dealing with a milveh alpeh, you can go after the Yershim, you can't go after the Lekuchot. So now, our case. Our case is you have each of the brothers has 2.5 seller. Remember, the estate was limited to a 5 seller estate. That was the first assumption, that we're dealing with a limited asset estate that only has 5 seller in it. They divided up 2.5, 2.5 to each of them. That 2.5, according to Rav Asi, is comprised of 50% Lekuchot, 50% Yershim. And then the other brother too, 50% Yusha, 50% Lekuchot. That means that the Pidyon HaBen, which is written in the Torah, is only a milveh alpeh, according to this. That's the assumption we made. And, according to Rav Papa, when you have a milveh alpeh, you can only go after the Yershim, you can't go after the Kuchot. That means from each of the brothers, you can get 1.25 sela. You can take half of what they got in Yerusha from the estate, because that's Yerusha. You can't go after the other 50%, because that they're deemed to be the Kuchot for. And so therefore, you could only collect out of the total 5 sela of the estate, you could only at this point collect 2.5 sela. Now, that's the machloki between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, which is, v'hacha, b'chamesh, v'lo b'chatzi chamesh, kamiflige. They argue about whether a pigeon and a ben exist at less than 5 shekel. Does the Torah, when it specifies that you have to pay 5 shekel for pigeon and a ben, is it 5 shekel or bust? Or is it whatever you can't pay up to the 5 shekel, and then you have to make up the rest whenever you can? That's their machloket. The Rabbi Meir savar chamesh v'lo chatzi chamesh. That's exactly what Rabbi Meir says. Rabbi Meir says, you pay 5 or you pay nothing. And over here you can't pay 5 because you can only get 2.5 from the estate. Therefore you don't pay anything. So again, the father already was obligated. We passed the 30-day point. When you pass the 30-day point, the father became obligated and the nechasim are mishubadim. There's a lien on the property. So as long as there's a lien on the property, Rabbi Yehuda says you gotta pay it. Lien on the property, gotta pay. Rabbi Meir says it depends. If the estate is aggregated, yeah, then you have to pay. If the estate has been dissolved, and now the dissolution creates it that the 50% is with one brother, 50% with the other brother, then you can't collect it. So now we understand that. Rabbi Meir is saying that while the estate is together, you already have a lien on the estate, you can go get the money, because there are 5 sell on the estate, and that's what you're owed, you can go and collect it. Once you've divided up the estate, now you have a problem. It's classified as a milveh peh. And each brother got 2.5 sela. That 2.5 sela is half, 50% Yerusha, 50% Likuchot. That means that you can only get 1 1/4 from each brother, 2.5 total. You don't get a full 5 sela. You're not allowed to collect over here. It goes by the wayside. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, Chamesh, Vafilu Chatzi Chamesh. Rabbi Yehuda says that you can collect even less than Chamesh. And that's why you can go. The lien exists, and therefore you can go after the property here as well. Mar says, that's their machloket. If the Rabbi Yehuda is saying here, nitzchaivu anechasim, the reason that you can go after the property, whether it's pre the split or after the split, is because there's a lien on the property, it should say nitzchave gavra mibayle. It's nothing to do with the nechasim, it has to do with the obligation of the individual. Rashi over here says, it's not nitzchayev gavra or chayev gavra mibayle, because Rabbi Yehuda says, chayavim. The reason that they're paying over here is because they're chayav, she'ena piturim legamrei, because they're not totally pador. The reason that they're chayav over here has nothing to do with the encumbrance or the lien on the property, but rather to the fact that you have to pay even less than 5 sela. The whole machlogan here is about this issue of chamesh, below chatzi chamesh, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda's answer to Rabbi Meir should not have been nitzchayvu anechasim, but rather chayavim. Just like Rabbi Meir says turim, Rabbi Yehuda on the other hand says chayavim. And it's not about the shibud karka that makes the difference, it's a totally different issue. That's the way Rashi explains it. The Rabbeinu Gershom on the other hand says, Iochi delachar lamed kamairi, if we're speaking about after 30 days, nitchayev gavra mibayle, it should say that the gavra is chayav. Because both according to Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, after 30 days, there's a lien on the property. That's not the difference in their opinion. They both agree to that, that there's a chiyuv, there's a lien on the property. The difference in their position is about what the individual's obligation is. Whether he pays less than 5 shekel or doesn't pay less than 5 shekel. So you should have expressed the machloket differently. So now the Gemara says, Ve'od, in addition to that, Tanya Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Achin Shechalku, brothers that divide up an estate, Mish Asara Zuz Lazeh, Vasara Zuz Lazeh. If they each get 10 zuz, which is 20 zuz, 20 zuz is 5 sela. It's the equivalent of what you owe for pidyon ha-ben. Every sela has 4 zuz in it. So 5 times 4 is 20. If they're splitting up the estate and each one of them is getting 10 zuz, that means the estate has exactly 5 sela in it. Chayavin. Then they are chayav. V'imav, if you have less than amount, turim. Then they don't have to pay. So, my atzara zuz lezeh, vasara zuz lezeh. What exactly is the scenario where they each got 10 zuz? Ilema ben de Yerusha, ben de Lekuchot. If you're telling me that that's the amount they got, both for the Yerusha and the Lekuchot, v'chamesh, v'achilu chatzi chamesh, and then you have to pay no matter what, even if you have less than 5 sela to pay to the Kohen, you still have to pay it. Yochi ma'iri atzara. Then why is there a difference to whether you have 10 zuz? Even if it was less than 10 zuz, you would still have to pay whatever amount that you could pay. Then why does it say in the Braita that if you have 10 zuz, you're chayav? Less than that, you are patur. According to this, it has nothing to do with 10 zuz, you're chayav. You'd be chayav if you have 8 zuz. You have 6 zuz. whatever you, 50% of whatever you're getting, you're going to have to pay to the Kohen, because we make you pay even less than 5 sela. El pshita, asara zuz dirusha lazeh, asara zuz dirusha lazeh. You see that each one of them is getting a full 10 zuz of Yerusha. Alma, you see from this, chamesh, velo chatzi chamesh. If that's the case, then Rav Yehuda clearly believes that you only pay a full 5 sela, not less than a 5 sela, which means that the estate was really comprised of, let's say, 40 zuz. It's comprised of 10 sela. When you divided up the estate, then each party got 20 zuz. That 20 zuz is divided by 50-50. 50% of it is Yerusha, 50% of it is Lukuchot. That 50% that is Yerusha is obligated towards the Pidyon HaBen. And that's what the Brita is saying, that if in the Yerusha portion you have 10 zuz, which will then make it that you're paying the full 5 sela to the Kohen between the two brothers, then you're obligated to pay. But if it's less than 10 zuz in the Yerusha portion, then you don't have to pay the Kohen, which means that Rabbi Yehuda is saying exactly what we said he didn't say before, which is only 5 sela and no less than 5 sela. And that's why the Brita here says he's chayav by asara zuz, patur for less than asara zuz. If that's true, then it doesn't work in the way we set up the machloket. We set up the machloket between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda exactly on this point. Rabbi Yehuda thinks that you pay even less than 5 sela. Rabbi Meir says you only pay 5 sela or nothing. But here we have a Brita that seems to indicate Rabbi Yehuda says the same thing, that you pay 5 sela or you don't pay at all. You can see from this, Ama chamesh lo chatzi chamesh, svirle. Ella, we have to come up with a different explanation of their machloket. Tukuli Alma chamesh velo chatzi chamesh. Everybody agrees. Now, we know that both Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda agree that either you pay the full 5 sela or you don't pay at all. The Bali Tosafot just point out over here that we don't always invoke this principle, because there are other places in the Torah where you have obligations, and we don't say, well, if you can't pay the whole obligation, you don't pay less than that. And Tosafot points out there's a big difference between a mitzvah that has a requirement of payment, whereby the mitzvah can only be accomplished by full payment, not by partial payment, versus where you have obligations to pay, whether it's restitution or whether it's other reasons why you owe money to an individual. Over there, you don't say either it's the whole amount or it's nothing, because over there, there's an obligation of payment. It's not a mitzvah that you're trying to accomplish. It's only by a mitzvah that you're trying to accomplish where we say this concept of it's either everything or nothing, whereas by payment, you can make payments in incremental amounts. Tosafot then goes on to say, once you have the full 5 sela, you don't have to give the whole 5 sela to one coin. You can divide it up and hand 1/5 to one coin, 1/5 to another coin, 1/5 to a third coin. You can divide it up any way you want. It's not an obligation to pay 5 sela in one aggregated amount to one coin. It means that you have to pay the full 5 sela to however many coin that you choose to, as long as you're paying the full 5 sela. Now their machloket is about all the assumptions we made before. In order to get to their machloket, we made two big assumptions, one of which is that Ravasi, that your chetzi lukukot, chetzi Yerusha. The other one was Rav Papa, that when it comes to Milva HaPeh, you can only collect from the Yershim, you can't collect from the lukukot. And that they'll argue about. Ehacha b'Ravasi or b'Rav Papa kamiflegei. They argue in the Shita of Ravasi or in the Shita of Rav Papa, which means, as Rashi explains over here, that Rabbi Meir clearly holds of Ravasi and Rav Papa. So when you have an estate with exactly 5 sela in it, and according to Rabbi Meir, that means that according to Ravasi, you split the estate up. The 50% that goes to each individual is 50% Yerusha, 50% Lekuchot. Then you have Rav Papa, who says when you come to collect, you can only collect Milva HaPeh from your Shim, not from Lekuchot. That means if the Kohen comes to collect you, he's only going to get 2.5 out of the 5 sela. And everybody agrees that when it's less than 5 sela, you get nothing. That's Rabbi Meir's view. Rabbi Yehuda is going to dissent in one of those two areas. Either he's going to say that I hold a Gravasi, that when you divide up the estate, it's 50% Yerusha, 50% Lekuchot, but I do not subscribe to Rav Papa, but rather a Milva HaPeh can go after both the Lekuchot and the Yerusha. So that'll make the difference over here. In a state that's exactly 5 sela, each brother's going to get 2.5 sela. That 2.5 sela is 50% Lekuchot, 50% Yerusha. So now, according to Rabbi Meir, only the Yerusha part is paid over here, because the Milva HaPeh is only collected from Yerushim. That means you're going to get a total of 2.5 sela. That's less than 5. You don't get it. Rabbi Yehuda says, Ravasi's right. It's 50% Yerusha, 50% Lekuchot. But Rav Papa's wrong. The din should be that when it's milval pe, you can go after both Yerusha and the Lukuchot. That means you can go after all the money here. If you can go after all the money here, then he gets a full five sela. If he gets a full five sela, then that's good enough. It's a full five sela. You can collect from them and take the money and collect for the pidyon haben. So that's one way to explain the machloket. The other possibility is that he doesn't hold the ravasi. Ella, everything is Yerusha. That we don't say it's 50-50, but rather it's Yerusha. When the brothers inherited, each one of them got 2.5 sela, it's Yerusha. He does hold the Rav Papa. You can only collect from your shim, not from the kuchot. But here, there's only Yerusha. 2.5 sela, 2.5 sela, that's 5 sela Yerusha. It adds up to the 5 sela. You'll be able to collect. And that'll be the machlok between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Either in this din of Ravasi, they'll argue, or in the din of Rav Papa, they will argue. The truth is that the Bali Tosafot point out that Rabbi Yehuda's shita in the Gemara in Kiddushin is that milvah tuva b'Torah, a milvah that's written in the Torah, is kemilvah b'shtar damio. It's as if it is in a shtar. So, if that's the case, then he says over here, near the Faresh, the Fiyah Maskana, the Lab Mamashkara Papa Kamar, that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't really hold of Rabbi Papa, because he believes milvah tuva b'Torah is kemilvah b'shtar damio. And therefore, you'd be able to collect both from the Kuchot and from the Yorshim. And so really, Rav Yehuda's arguing on that position of Rav Papa. And Tosafot actually uses that to explain the two views of Rav Papa, one in Kiddushin, whereby we say that the reason that Rav Papa says you can collect from the Yorshim and not from the Kuchot is because it's Shibuda de Uraita. Because in the Gemara in Kiddushin, it's talking about a milvah tuva b'Torah. On the other hand, in Bava Batra, Rav Papa says the reason that you can collect from the Yerushim and the Kuchot is Shlotin Ol Delet B'Pnei Lavin, that's speaking about a Milvah Alpeh, that's not Ketuvah B'Torah. And therefore, that's the difference in the reasoning given for Rav Papa, but that makes it clear that Rav Yehuda disagrees with Rav Papa, because Rav Yehuda believes that Milvah Ketuvah B'Torah is Ketuvah B'Shtar Damya, you could even go after the Kuchot. That means in the conclusion here in the Gemara, it's clear that Rav Yehuda argues on Rav Papa. So therefore, in the end, when we say that Rav Yehuda doesn't hold the Rav Papa, and you can't collect from the Lekuchot, it's not because he thinks that a Milva Peh can be collected from the Lekuchot, it's rather because he thinks the Milva Ketuva B'Torah is Kemilva Ketuva B'Shtar Damyo. And that's why he argues on Rav Papa's position, because it's pretty pashut throughout the Shas, as Tosafot says, that a Milva Peh cannot be taken from the Lekuchot. And so the main statement of Rav Papa is the Apuke Rabin Shmuel's position, who believed that a Milvah Peh can't even take from the Yorshim. The Papa says you can take it from the Yorshim, but there's nobody who believes that you can also take it from the Lekuchot. And therefore, the Machloket is really premised on Milvah Ketuva B'Torah, Ketuva B'Shtar Damya. So now the Gemara continues and says, Vika Dematni La Seifa. Some make this statement on the Seifa. Nitchaivu Anechasim. When Rabbi Yehuda says that the Nechasim are encumbered, or there's a lien on the Nechasim, Demita Av Emat. When did the father pass away? So instead of being on Rabbi Meir's position, now it's on Rabbi Yehuda's position. Ilema Demit Lachar Shloshim. If it's the fact that he died after 30 days, Bechlal the Rabbi Meir Savar Ki Chalku Pturim. So now you're going to say, according to Rabbi Meir, when they divide up the property in Patur, Haishtadilu Nechse. The possessions already were encumbered. Rabbi Meir agrees, after 30 days there was an obligation, there's a lien on the possession. Ela betoch shloshim yom. Rather, it's within 30 days. Ki chalku amai mechayiv Rabbi Yehuda. Why does Rabbi Yehuda say you're chayav after you divided up the estate? Lizel gabi hai lidche. Goes to one brother, you'll say it's the other brother. Gabi hai lidche. Goes to the other brother and say it's the other brother. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, why should you be able to collect in that case? Because there's nobody to go after, or no single entity to go after. Samar Rabbi Yirmiya, zoto merit. So from our mission, you see, Shnei Yosef and Shimon, Shayubi Yair Achat, they have two Yosef and Shimons that are in a single city, a creditor extended credit to a Yosef and Shimon. So now he goes to collect, one of them says, it wasn't me, it was the other guy. Goes to the second guy, he says, it wasn't me, it was the other guy. And one of them purchased the property from the other. Balchov Gova Mimenu. The Balchov, the creditor, can go after it, Mimonov Shach. Because, Damalei, if it's you who I extended the credit to, then I'm going after your property. And if it was your other compatriot who has the same name that I lent the money to, I had a lien on this property before you bought it. and therefore it's mine, irrespective of shach. But now they have a piece of property where they both owned it, because he purchased the property from the other Yosef and Shimon. But as he says, listen, of shach, I have a right to this property, either because you're my debtor, and therefore you owe me the money, or because he was my debtor, and my lien preceded your purchase of the property, and therefore I have a right to the property before you. What's interesting over here is Rabbi Yirmiyah changed his tune. Even though the case is the same in the Mishnah, Rabbi Meir now gives a different example. Question is, why did he switch examples? The Rabbeinu Gershom over here says he switched the examples because before we made the assumption that it was pre the splitting of the estate was the case, and therefore he brought a situation that matches pre-splitting. In this scenario, we're suggesting that it's post the splitting of the estate that there machloket exists, and therefore he brings an example of post-splitting where you would have a similar type of case. And that's why over here it spoke about the kuchot, and then over there it spoke about shutafut, because it matches the case in the Mishnah that we are discussing. Then Omar Rava. Rava now asks the same question he asked before. Michtei nechsoi debarinish inun areven bay. The possessions of an individual are his guarantor. And if that's the case, how can you go after the land when you can't go after the debtor himself? Or you can't go after the lakuach himself. How can you go after his property, which is the guarantor? And then the Gemara says, v'kula kalish nekama. And then continue the Gemara, like etc., like we did in the first case, which is Elom Arova, that their makloket is based on the assumption that everybody holds a Ravasi, everybody holds a Rav Papa, makloket about Chamesh. Velo chatzi chamesh. We reject that and say, no, it can't be about that, but that their machloket is about the case where there's only five sela in the estate. It's post the death of the father, and they all believe that you can only take five and not less than five. And the machloket is within either Ravasi or Rav Papa's shita. Rabbi Meir holds of Rav Papa and Ravasi. Rabbi Yehuda argues on one of those two points, either on Rav Papa or on Ravasi, that Rabbi Yehuda rejects one of the two of them. Next Mishnah, Shtei Nashim Shelo Bichru. Two women have yet to give birth. V'yaldu Shnei Zecharim. And then they gave birth to two males. And this is two women who are married to a single individual. That man, Notain Yud Slayim the Kohen. Mimon of Shach, he has a Bechor from this woman, a Bechor from this woman. Even though he doesn't know which of the two children belong to which woman, doesn't matter. He owes the Kohen 10 Sela. He has to pay for the Pidyon of it. Meite Chad Mehem B'tok Shloshim Yom. If one of the two children dies within the 30 days, im le kohen echad natan, if he gave all the money to one kohen, then yakzir lo chamesh slayim. Then he's got to credit back five selah, because he knows, bimonav shach, one of the two children that he paid for was not supposed to be paid for, and therefore he's got to refund that money back to the father. Im le shnei kohanim natan, if he gave it to two different kohanim, and obviously he didn't specify which child he was giving to which kohen, he can't get the money back. He goes to one kohen and says, give me back the pigeon of Ben. He says, sorry, the bechor that I got the money for is still alive. It's the other guy's bechor that died. He goes to the other guy, he says the same thing. And then there's no way to get the money back. Zachar unikeva. If the two wives gave birth to a male and a female, oshne zacharim unikeva, or two males and a female, notein chamesh leim the kohen. Then he pays five sela to the kohen, meaning that you have a safek bechor here. One of them for sure is a bechor, miman of shach. That's because either there was a male and female born, and so one of the women had a bechor. Or when you have two zacharim and a nekeva, then again, one of the women had to have a zachar first. Could be that the zacharim or twin boys were born to one woman, and therefore one of the twins was a bechor, the other one is not. And then the other woman had a nekeva, is not chayavet at all. Or it could be that the one woman had a zachar and a nekeva, but the nekeva came out first, not the zachar. And then the other woman had a zachar, therefore you're chayav in pidyon ben. Or it could be that they both gave birth to a zacharim first, and then the nekeva came afterwards by one of the women. Then you'd be chayav for two. But that's only one of the three scenarios. It's a safek. So as far as getting 10 sela, you can't. But as far as 5 sela, for sure, one of the children is a bechor over here, and therefore you pay 5 sela to the kohen. Shtei nekevot v'zachar, if there are two females and a male, o shnei zacharim v'shtei nekevot, ain't kan the kohen klom. Then the kohen gets nothing over here, because there's a possibility that each woman had a nekeva first, or there's a possibility that one of them had a nekeba, then a zachar, and the other one had a nekeba, that's the case, then you don't pay to the Kohen, even though there are scenarios where the zacharim could have come out first. Could be that there are two bechorim here. But since it's a safek, and you're not going to pay in this case. Achat bichra, v'chat shlo bichra. It's two wives, one of which has given birth before, one of which has yet to have given birth. V'yaldu shnei zacharim. And then there are two males that are born. Natein chamesh shleim lekohen. Then he pays five sela because only one of the two is a bechor, even though he has no idea which one of those two is a bechor. Meit achad mehen, betok shloshim yom. If one of them dies within the 30 days, then ab patur. The father no longer has to pay. Now that assumes that he has yet to have paid the Kohen. If he had already paid the Kohen, then you have the same problem that you had before, which is that the Kohen can say that the one that died was the pashut and not the bechor. Therefore, I don't have to give you back the money. But if the father hasn't paid yet, he doesn't have to pay here. Meitav, if the father passes away, babanim kayamim. And now the children are still around. Rabbi Meir Omer, im natanu ad shelo chalku. If they gave the chamesh sela before they divided up the estate, natanu, they gave it, or they need to give it. Vim lav, if they didn't give the five sela before they divided the estate, turim, then they're patur. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, nitchaivu nechasim. The nechasim are already obligated over here. There's a lien on the property, and therefore, even if they do split it up, you have to pay the five sela. This will have to have the same explanation as we had in the previous Mishnah. And Tosva notes that you need some sort of tzrichuta as to why the Gemara here repeated this machloket of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda over here, like it did in the previous Mishnah. The Gemara never says why do we need it to be repeated twice. But Tosva says you need to find some reason to repeat it twice, some reasoning that would make you thought differently in this scenario versus the previous scenario. In the case before, it's one woman who gives birth to two children, and that's where the safek is. Over here, it's two women who are the wives of one individual who give birth. So it's a slightly different case, and you'll have to figure out why the Mishnah needs to repeat this machloket Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda over here. But obviously, it'll be subject to the same things that we mentioned before as to their machloket. In the previous Mishnah, will be the same machloket that they have over here. Zachar nekeva, in this instance, if there's a male and female born, in the Kohen klum. Kohen gets nothing. Because it could be that the Nekeva was born to the woman who has yet to give birth, and the Zachar was born to the woman who already gave birth, and therefore there's no Bechor over here, there's a Safek, you don't pay the Kohen. Next scenario is, Shtei Nashim, Shoshnei Anashim. So here we have two women who are married to two different individuals. Shalo Bechru, both of them have yet to have given birth. Yodu Bet Zacharim. And then we have a case where they both gave birth to males. Zenotein Chamesh Lanim, the Kohen, Zenotein Chamesh Lanim, the Kohen. Both fathers have to pay, because Miman of Shach, they have a Bechor over here. May not know which of the babies is the Bechor, or their Bechor, but they have a Bechor for sure. Meit echad mehem etoch shloshim, one of the two babies dies within the first 30 days, im lekohen echad natnu. If they already had paid the pidyon aben to a single Kohen, yachzir lehem chamesh shloim, then he hands them back five sela, and the fathers have to work it out between them, or basically split it between them. But the Kohen says, I am Miman of Shach, entitled to one pidyon bechor here, but the other one, you're right, he died, so I'm going to refund it. Im l'shnei kohanim natanu, they gave it to two separate kohanim, inam yochulim notzi mehem. You can't get it back, because each kohen will say the one that died was the other kohen's pidyon ben. The one that's alive is my pidyon ben. Zachar nekeva, if they gave birth to a male and female, we don't know which mother gave birth to which, avot turim. Over there, the fathers are now exempt from paying, because each one of them, it's a safek as to whether he's chayav. You can't get the money from them. On the other hand, the son is for sure a bechor. He may not know from which father, but he is a bechor for sure, because both mothers were peterechem. And so he has to redeem himself. He has an obligation to pay for himself. In this scenario, if there were two females and a male born, ain't kind of going klum. Then the Kohen gets nothing, because there's a possibility in the permutations of what could have happened here, that they both had nekevot first, and that means that there is no bechor here whatsoever. Achat bichra, v'chat shlo bichra. Sheshnei anashim. Here with two women, each one of them married to a different man, and one of them has given birth before, one has not given birth before. V'yaldu shnei zacharim. And then there are two males born. Zeh shlo bichra, ishto, the one whose wife had yet to have given birth, Notein chamesh shleim the Kohen. He's got to pay the Kohen five sela because he had a bechor. Miman of Shach, we don't know
which of the two is his, but he definitely had a bechor here. Zachar and a keva, he can't the kohen kulum. If you have a male and a female, then the kohen doesn't get anything at all, because it's possible that the one who gave birth before had the male, and the one who didn't have given birth before had the female, and therefore there is a possibility that the kohen has no rights here whatsoever. Maishna shnei kohanim da'aza legabe hai umidachilei. How come in the case where you have two kohanim, when two fathers pay the kohanim, when it's given to one kohen, they can go after that kohen and say, give us back the 5 shekel. If they gave it to two kohanim, they can't go after the kohen, because each one of them says to go to the other one. Each kohen that you go to, he says, go to the other kohen, because the one that I redeemed is still alive. Kohen echad nami. Why don't you say the same thing by a single kohen? Leza legabi hai v'lidche. When one father shows up, you'll say to him, you don't have entitlement here. And then you go to the other father and say, you don't have entitlement here. So Amar Shmuel, Biba Beharsha. It's a case where he comes with a power of attorney. So again, when you have two fathers and you're dealing with two kohanim, then each time they go to a kohen, that kohen says, the one that's alive is the one that I got the money for and I'm okay. Go to the other kohen. And vice versa, goes to the other kohen, he says, the one that's alive is my pidyon. The other one that died belongs to the other kohen, go to the other kohen. We said there that they can't get any money back, get any refund for the fact that one of them died. On the other hand, when it's a single kohen, they can get a refund. Question is, why can they get a refund? Father A shows up to the kohen and says, pay me back. He says, I don't owe you the money, I owe it to Father B. Father B shows up and he says, I don't owe you the money, I owe it to Father A. And the same way that they deflect, then when there are two kohanim, a single kohen can deflect them as well and say, I don't need to refund you any money over here. Neither one of you is sure that you're the claimant over here. And so therefore I don't have to respond to you. The answer to the Gemara is that you came by Shah. The two fathers wrote a power of attorney to each other whereby one father can act on behalf of both of them, both for himself and through a power of attorney for the other father. So now you're a single claimant that's coming to make a claim against the kohen. He can't say, oh, it's the other party. I'm representing both parties here. And since I'm representing both parties, I can make a claim against you. It says, V'amrei naradai, lo kadvinan adrachta, or really, the Gersa probably should be, erkata ametautale. We don't write harsha'ot on non-real property, on metautale. Over here, that's what you're doing. You're writing harsha'ot to collect the cash that was given to the kohen for the pidyon event. You're not writing harsha'ot on property, you're writing harsha'ot on a obligation. Gemara says, "Hani mileicha de kafre." That's only true when there's a denying party on the other side. Leicha de lo kafre katvina. But if there's no denying party on the other side, we allow a harsha to be written. Since Rashi explains over here, the reason is that when you write a harsha, it's as if you're giving a power of attorney and Edim are signing on it, saying you can go collect on behalf of me. When they didn't sign on it, it makes it look like there's really an obligation to collect. That obligation now, you're empowered to collect on behalf of this party. If, on the other hand, the party that is being claimed against, the defendant over here says, I don't owe any money, there's no obligation over here, how can you have witnesses sign on a document that says, this obligation that so-and-so owes me, you have a right to collect? That's as if they're verifying that there is such an obligation when the other party says no obligation exists at all. So it's mechse kashikra. It looks like a lie to sign on such a document and say you have a right to collect the obligation when there's no obligation, or the other party's denying the obligation. Or basically you're empowering a party to go collect something on your behalf that another person says you don't have a right to. So how is it that they're signing on a empowerment to collect when that collection is not even something that we're certain you can collect? Over here, the kohen doesn't deny the fact that he owes money to one of the two fathers. He just says, it's not you, it's the other one. Or it's not you, it's the other one. And in that case, there he knows that he owes the money, he just doesn't know to whom that money is owed. And since he doesn't know to whom, he doesn't have an obligation to give it. It's motzim echavero alavaraya. Here you can write harsha, because here he doesn't deny the obligation. The obligation clearly exists, and therefore you can create a power of attorney that empowers the other party to collect in this situation. And the Rabbeinu Tam says that the reason that today we write harshot even when there is a denial by the other party is because in a totally unrelated case, the Gemara says that we don't worry about mechseik and shikra. And since we don't worry about shikra, then we also don't worry about writing harshot for metaltalim, even in the case where there is a denial by the other party. That's why we write our show, the powers of attorney today, even when the claim is not assured. The truth is that there is another view in the Gemara and Baba Kama that we don't write harsha'ot a metaltalim, period. Because a harsha'ah basically is a granting of a kinyan in your ownership in a particular item. And the problem is that by metaltalim, it's something where you can't transfer the kinyan of those items because it's enum bishuto. Those items aren't in his possession right now. And just like you can't make a kinyan or grant a kinyan or be maktish things that are not in your reshut, you can't then give that over by Shah to someone else. And therefore, Shah is not relevant by metaltalim. So Tosfot over here says, according to that Shita, how does it work over here that the two parties can come together and collect from the Kohen in order to make the Mishnah be true over here that you can get a refund of the 5 selah when it was given to one Kohen? So Tosfot gives a number of answers, the last of which is, Odesh Lateres, the Dilma in Shneim Mitzuyim Lefanenu. If both fathers are standing in front of us, mitzavim latet le'echad mehem, and they are saying to give it to one of them, chayav lachzir. So it's a case where not each father came independently to the Kohen, but they came jointly to the Kohen. So there's no need for harsha'ah anymore because both parties are standing in front of us at this point. Therefore, they don't have to set up the Mishnah as a case where there's baba harsha'ah, because that's only when one party is coming to represent both parties. But when both parties are there, you don't need a harsha'ah, and they can say, listen, between us, give us the money. We're both here. You owe one of us the money. And one of them says, give the money to the other guy, and he'll collect on my behalf. Once he's done that, then they're both present, and you don't need a harsha'ah anymore. You don't need a kinyan anymore. Maybe in that case, you'll be able to collect. And that's how that shita in the Gemara and Baba Kama, that harsha'ot are not written for metaltalim, will explain our Mishnah. Zachar nekeva ain't got the goyen klum. In the latter part of the Mishnah, if you have a zachar nekeva, Kohen gets nothing. Tana Ravuna. Ravuna adds in an additional case. In a case where you have two women married to two men, both women who have yet to have given birth. In that situation, Ravuna adds another case, which is shnei zacharim nekeva, and the Kohen klum. If you have two males and nekeva that are born in that case, the Kohen can't get anything out of it. Because, yes, mimon of shach, there was a bechor over here. No matter what, there was a bechor, but we don't know which father is the obligated party. Given that, the Kohen doesn't have any ability to collect over. He goes to one father, he says, I'm not the one with the bechor. The other guy had a bechor. I had a female first. Goes to the other father, he says the same thing. I had the female first, I'm not chayav in bechor. Because so given that, the outcome is the same there, that ain't the Kohen klum. The Tana didon, our Tana, why didn't he include that case? Came into b'shnei anashimu the mishkachala. That's only true when there are two fathers and their wives both have not given birth. But in a case of Isha Chad and Shtein Hashem, if it was one husband with two wives, both of whom have not given birth yet, that situation, lo mishkachada, in that case, he's chayav mimon of shoch, he's chayav 5 selah, because at least one of these is the Bechor, and he's the only party that's obligated over here. Therefore, therefore he didn't include it in the Mishnah. So it's not that our Tana disagrees with that case, but rather, it's because it doesn't fit all the scenarios of the Mishnah. The Mishnah has multiple scenarios. It has scenarios involving one husband and two wives. And then within that scenario, there are different permutations where either both wives have yet to have given birth or one of the two wives has yet to have given birth. Then we have another series of cases in which it's two husbands who are married to two wives respectively. And each one of those wives, then we have two permutations. Either where both of them have yet to have given birth, or one of them has yet to have given birth. And all our Tana is saying is that we want cases or situations that fit through all of those scenarios, all of those permutations. If you use the case of two zecharim and a keva, it's true by the cases of two husbands and two wives, that over there, nobody would be chayav, because the Kohen can't find the right party to is obligated, and he can't prove which party is obligated. So yes, it's true, but that case would not be true in the Reisha. And since it wouldn't be in the true in the Reisha, where there's one husband and two wives, therefore he didn't enter that case into the Mishnah at all, because he wanted to keep the cases of the Mishnah consistent, where the din has application by both Isha Chad and Shnei Nashim, and Shnei Nashim im Shnei Nashim. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Mem Tet, Amud Aleph.